From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For stories baked into the heart and soul of a culture, you don't have to look further than the fairy tales of the Grimm brothers. Cinderella, Rapunzel, Hansel and Gretel, magic and adventure, riddles and witches, and a healthy dose of the grim and the gory. Our guest today, folklore and mythology scholar Maria Tatar, says dark and light, these stories are about what it means to be human. This hour on Point, the tales of the Brothers Grimm. You can join the conversation. Did you grow up with these stories, with their adaptations and parodies from Disney to Looney Tunes to opera and ballet? Do they enlighten? Do they frighten? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Disney, of course, moved in big on Grimm Brothers' tales in the 20th century. His Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, released in 1937, making it the country's first animated feature film. Here's Lucia Laverne as the Wicked Queen and Maroni Olsen as the Magic Mirror.
Magic mirror on the wall, who is the fairest one of all?
Famed is thy beauty, Majesty. But hold, a lovely maid I see. Rags cannot hide her gentle grace. Alas, she is more fair than thee.
And off we go into the land of fairy tales. Walt Disney there, feasting on the Grimm brothers. Joining me now in our studio is Maria Tatar, professor of Germanic languages and literatures and chair of the Folklore and Mythology Program at Harvard University, editor of the annotated classic fairy tales, the annotated Hans Christian Andersen and the annotated Peter Pan, translator and editor of the new bicentennial edition of the annotated Brothers Grimm. Maria Tatar, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here, Tom.
Bicentennial, 200 years since what exactly?
Well, the Brothers Grimm published their collection in 1812, Volume 1, and followed by a second volume and then a third, which contained footnotes, annotations. Mm. So these brothers started, they were scholars. They wanted to preserve Germany's cultural heritage, the cultural heritage of German-speaking countries, mm-hmm. and also to try to connect with the pagan past. They believed that these stories were not just magical, but also mythical. They took up primal matters, beliefs, customs, and values.
1812, two German brothers. Where do they live in Germany?
They're living in Kassel and in the vicinity. And
what part of Germany is that?
So they're in the sort of mid-regions, mm-hmm. And Hessen, and they are recording the folk tales, not just from, you know, we have this fantasy that they sort of went to the countryside and talked to peasants.
Sat down with the old lady,
yes,
at the hearth and said, well, how did they do it then?
What they did was they...
I love your laugh, by the way. It'd be good in a Disney movie. It's got a little bit of
the Wicked Queen. I've been watching too much Snow White.
No, how did they? How did they come
and,
up with these?
They talked to the people that they knew. Their informants were, for the most part, middle class. They were tailors. They were farmers' wives. They were cousins. And wherever they could find them, they got the tales. They also wrote to their friends in other regions and asked, wanted to get fairy tales from all over, not just from their own particular location.
Is there a way of knowing, or what's the verdict on whether these were indeed a fair and good and deep representation of good old German folk tales, or whether these were, I don't know, stuff somebody, you know, made up on the back of an envelope because those Grimm brothers were bugging them for a story?
They worried about that. And in fact, what they did, of course, was to collect multiple versions of different stories. They had several versions of Snow White, one of which had a biological mother who abandons the child. Oh. So they could sort of pick and choose. And then the genius of the Brothers Grimm was really to create a compact fairy tale form, one that was a sort of a hybrid of the oral narrative, the tale that was told around the fireside, and then the literary tale. Mm-hmm. So they didn't embellish too much. They kept it short and simple. And I think because of that, parents found the stories attractive for bedtime reading.
Did they know how attractive they were going to be, or didn't they set out to do something that was just more of a kind of scholarly cataloging here?
they had no idea how successful the volume would become. In fact, they were quite shocked when they discovered that the book was actually selling quite well. The only problem was many of the reviewers did not appreciate the vulgar language in the tales. And parents wrote to the Grimms, told them that they also were offended by some of the allusions to pregnancy. Rapunzel, in the first version of her story, is up in the tower. There are these daily romps with the prince, and she becomes pregnant as a result. But in the Grimms rewrote the story, and suddenly she just becomes pregnant, and there's no connection with the prince at all. There's a story about a boy who looks at young women and makes them pregnant, and that one quickly disappeared. It was not child friendly. So they toned down not the violence, but the allusions to anything that was bawdy or racy.
There's so much we want to learn here. You're whetting our appetite in lots of directions. I wish you'd read for us from, this is your translation of the Grimm Brothers German here, and this is not Disney's Snow White, but their Snow White. There's a lot to look at and many stories, but just take us into this one a bit. Maria Tartar reading her own translation, the Grimm Brothers Snow White.
Once upon a time, in the middle of winter, when snowflakes the size of feathers were falling from the sky, a queen was sitting and sewing by a window with an ebony frame. While she was sewing, she looked out at the snow and pricked her finger with a needle. Three drops of blood fell onto the snow. The red looked so beautiful against the white snow that she thought, "If only I had a child as white as snow, as red as blood, and as black as the wood of the window frame." Not long after that, she gave birth to a little girl who was white as snow, red as blood, and black as ebony, and she was called Snow White. The queen died shortly after the child was born. A year later, her husband, the king, married another woman. She was a beautiful lady, but proud and domineering, and she could not bear the thought that anyone might be more beautiful than she was. She owned a magic mirror, and whenever she stood in front of it to look at herself, she would say, "Mirror, mirror, on the wall, who's the fairest one of all?" The mirror would always answer, "You, O queen, are the fairest of all." Then she was happy, for she knew that the mirror always spoke the truth.
And she was happy until the mirror let her know that there's someone fairer than
you. There's someone fairer, and this is a story about intergenerational rivalry. I love the way that it's been taken up by Hollywood in Snow White and the Huntsman. And you have not only
this
the sexual...
This is the recent one with... Who was in that? This is the
Charlize Theron.
That's right.
And Kristen Stewart. A wonderful chemistry between the rivalry between the two of them. And what happens in this new version is that you not only have the rivalry between the stepmother and daughter, but you also have a film that takes up environmental issues. The Wicked Queen emerges from an oil slick, so she's connected with environmental depredation, and Snow White represents
Salvation,
a return to nature, and you get
so
this.
So every generation's got their spin on it. But here we are, right back at the beginning. I mean, I'm struck as you're reading that by how sort of visually graphic it is, these stark colors,
exactly,
the white,
right,
the black, the red, the three drops of blood.
Primal.
Was that the Grimm Brothers making this artsy, artistic, or was that the way they told it around the
I think the brothers picked this up from the storytellers that they listened to. That is, these tales are action-packed. The characters travel very quickly and lightly. They do not carry much baggage. We don't see inside their minds.
But it's
just
so made
to
be
them.
Iconic. You know, it's white as snow, red as ebony. The windowsill has to be ebony.
Think of Sleeping Beauty. Mm. She is truly iconic, surrounded by that briar hedge, and the suitors who have died on those thorns, who have been stabbed and are bloody. So everything about these tales is visual. And I think that, You know, as we process all of that visual material and all of that plot, we start to go inside the characters and try to figure out what is making them tick.
Well, on the other side of Bruno Bettelheim and all the rest, we immediately want to see the psychodrama, the deep sort of psychic confrontations here. Did they look at it that way? Did they see the deep sort of roots of human interaction and psyche at battle?
The Grimms?
Yes.
Or, I think at times they did. I think they recognized that these are tales about family conflict and violence, and they understood that at a very deep level. But they also thought in mythical terms, so that, you know, for them, as for 19th century folklorists, Little Red Riding Hood is a story about the sun, which is swallowed on a daily basis by dark forces, the wolf predator, and then reemerges. So there's so many different ways in which these stories can be interpreted.
Maria Tatar is out with the bicentennial edition of the annotated Brothers Grimm. You can read the introduction to the book at our website, onpointradio.org. There's a lot we want to look at here. Do you still know these tales, still read them? Do parents still read Little Red Riding Hood to their kids? The whole weird, gory, wonderful thing? Do you remember being scared out of your wits by these? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. A little hello, little girl there from Sondheim's Into the Woods, where the wolf meets Red Riding Hood. We're talking today about the myth and dark magic of the Grimm brothers' fairy tales and the rough folk wisdom and fantasy they hold with Maria Tatar. She's translated and out with a great new annotated, wonderfully illustrated edition, big, bounteous book of fairy tales, the annotated Brothers Grimm. This is the bicentennial edition of the first 1812 publication of the first volume of their collection. Maria was saying this year's Snow White and the Huntsman made over the story of Snow White into a fantasy adventure epic starring Charlize Theron as the Wicked Queen.
Lips red as blood, hair black as night. Bring me your heart, my dear, dear Snow White.
Do we never get tired of these stories? In the popular children's radio program Let's Pretend, which aired for decades, here it was featuring one of the adaptations. This is from the Grimm brothers, Hansel and Gretel, 1954.
Once upon a time, there lived at the edge of a great forest a poor woodcutter and his two children, Hansel and Gretel. Because the children's mother had died when they were very young, the father married again, but his new wife was very selfish and cruel. And finally, one night, Hansel and Gretel overheard their stepmother urging a terrible plan on their father.
Hansel and Gretel, circa 1954, and it's a jaunty reading, Maria, but she's got plans for them, which are just grim, and it gets grimmer.
Oh, and the great thing is that the children fight back. What do they do? They overhear their parents, so they're eavesdropping. They're listening in.
The stepmother saying they must die.
They must die, and the Hansel and Gretel decide to go out and get Hansel gets the pebbles, and he finds a way back home. They have to keep outwitting their parents, and finally, there they are in the woods, and what do they? They're living in a time of famine. Mm-hmm. They grab some of that. Actually, in the Grimms, it's
is it a
windows
house made
of
candy and food?
Windows of sugar.
Sugar, and, yes, in the witch's house.
The roof is made of bread and all of that. Our gingerbread mm-hmm. house, mm-hmm. and they hear a voice, and what do? They start lying. They say it's just the wind that is nibbling on your house, mm-hmm. and. Hansel, of course, is put into a cage, and the minute he's imprisoned, Gretel uses her wits. She she's always a little behind Hansel, and she's also behind the witch when she shoves her in the oven and becomes what Anne Sexton, in her wonderful volume of rewrites poems about the Brothers Grimm's fairy tales, calls a cultural heroine. She's fast as Houdini. She sees her moment in history. So these
saves
children,
the day.
Yeah, with their wits and their cunning, they manage to find a way back home.
Were the Grimm brothers, did they take it as just a matter of course? I mean, there's, you know, murder and lies and, you know, just imprisonment and rape and cruelty abundant here. Was that just, well, of course? Or were they shocked at what they were hearing?
I think that they understood that these are stories which give us the worst case possible scenario. What if these counterfactuals, if the worst thing happens, how will you survive?
It's funny,
how
like there was manage? A bestseller just a couple of years ago, right? Worst case scenarios, and everybody brought it to read it for a holiday gift.
Yeah, and this is, you know, in some ways that's updating the fairy tales, the Grimm's fairy tales. And I think that that's the message they send to children, too, that you can survive no matter how bad the monsters are. You know, you will find a way out of the woods, and here's how.
Maybe that's encouraging. Maybe that's scarring. I'm not sure. I mean, we're prepared maybe for anything. Beth in Brookline is calling. Beth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm actually so happy that you called because I have, or you're putting this on the air right now, because I have an 8-year-old daughter and a 6-year-old daughter, and I get that it's good to hear the worst case possible scenario. But what about a story like Sleeping Beauty where the character is dead and then she comes back to life because a man looks at her and smiles at her in some way, and now she's able to come back to life and lead this happy life? And I find that just a really upsetting message, and there's so much misogyny in these stories. And so I'm so happy that you're talking about whether or not it really is good for kids, and like, how do you, I mean, are we allowed to tweak these kind of stories so that they're less misogynistic? And what's these stories are so weird with how the women end up so harmed. I'm just wondering how this all works.
You know, Beth, I'm sure you are by no means alone in wondering that as you sit down all cuddled up with the freshly bathed daughter and son or whatever in the evening, and then roll this out. Maria, speak to it. I mean, here's misogyny and violence and weirdness abundant. Duly noted, you're not a child psychologist, you're a folklorist, but what about
yes,
it?
Yes, I do.
Well, your mother?
We all love melodrama, but there is nothing sacred about the Grimm's version of the story. And the great thing is that we make these stories our own. We retell them. There's no reason why we should tell a 6-year-old the version of Cinderella as it was told by the Grimm's, as recorded by the Grimm's with the stepsisters getting their eyes pecked out.
And yet most people, I'm guessing most parents sit down and read from something. You could just tell off the top of your head. I bet most don't. Are you saying we should all buy the version of the story edited to our tender contemporary sensibilities?
No, I would say, first of all, every child is different. Some kids love to be scared out of their wits. You know, they want to hear about the gory things. And then, you know, they want to talk about them and figure out what's going on. What does that mean? They might listen. In France, if you are read the story of Little Red Riding Hood, it will end with the wolf gobbling up the little girl. And a lesson, a cautionary tale. Little Red Riding Hood doesn't make it out. But if you grew up in 16th century France, you will probably have heard a story in which the little girl outwits the wolf. Tells the wolf that she has to go relieve herself outdoors.
And off she goes.
Off she goes.
But here we are now, 21st century people. As a 21st century woman, what about Beth's question about the misogyny here? How do you take it on board?
I would say Sleeping Beauty exists in so many different versions today. You can read Anne Rice's erotic version of the story. This is a tale about death, about beauty, about mortality, about danger and peril, and all of these things. And we make of it what we will.
Did you read these uncut to your children? Did you?
No,
would you?
I did make my interest in fairy tales. It can be traced back to my childhood. But my second encounter with the Grimm's was when I made the mistake of reading The Juniper Tree to them. And I very quickly realized, as the stepmother is decapitating her stepson, that this was not necessarily that I had better start improvising.
What's decapitation mean, Mommy? Oh, God.
I had better, and of course, my daughter could read at the time, and she wanted the story as it was written down. She didn't want me to change anything.
Wow.
But I think the beauty of these tales is that you can then improvise. You can then talk about, why is this scary? You know, even very young children are scared about losing a body part. I mean, I can remember at night, your imagination runs wild, and
losing a body part, for heaven's sake. I mean, maybe it's too much to read here, but the version of Cinderella you've got here, they're not just, you know, straining to get their feet into these slippers. They're cutting off their toes, and the blood is spurting. They're chopping off their heels, these terrible sisters, not Cinderella. And there's blood all over the place as they do anything to jam them into that royal fate.
And the birds are singing about it.
Yeah.
It gets worse.
Oh, my gosh.
So
Jocelyn in Nashville, Tennessee. Jocelyn, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I wanted to just chime in. I caught you guys in the car, and I rushed home to my Bruno Bettelheim book.
Okay.
Check out this little fact. Does he mention in Sleeping Beauty, you guys were talking about the blood, you were talking about misogyny that another person raised, and you were saying about the whole pregnancy thing coming from just a glance. I've read somewhere that the blood that is referenced may have to do with menstrual blood, that when she, on her 16th birthday, she became, you know, she pricked her finger and that was the whole downfall. Is it when she became a woman, that is, her first period, that she became susceptible to getting this poison from the stepmother?
Yeah, all right. We're at the hearth. The women are gathered. Is this where we're going, Mother Maria?
It is one way of reading the story. It's not one that I buy into. If you read The Psychologist on Little Red Riding Hood, you'll find that the breaking of the bottle in the basket represents the loss of virginity. I don't think that works, really. And I think every time you see red in a tale, it's not necessarily menstrual blood or something like that. But certainly Sleeping Beauty could be seen as a story about the transition from childhood to, you know, this period of maturing. Bettelheim sees the sleep as a kind of adolescent sleep, a ripening, and all of that. So, well, why not if that's what makes the story meaningful to you? And, you know, I think that there's a way in which we each take this story, make it our own, make it personal, and if it develops its meaning in that way for you, that makes sense to me. There are millions of ways of reading these stories. They give us so little, and we have to add something to them to make the sense of them.
Jocelyn, thanks for your call. You mentioned the juniper tree. I wish you'd read a bit from that, Maria, if you could, and set us up here. I mean, this is, once again, it's a stepmother again, right? I mean, they're tough on stepmothers here. Or was it just a mother in the very original?
No, this was a stepmother in the version that the Grimms received from their friend Philip Otto Runge, painter.
And why does she want the boy gone, the son?
You could trace it to inheritance rights. She's got a biological daughter, so she wants that boy out of the way.
And she doesn't just get him out of the way. She feeds him to the father. Can you read for us?
She chops him up.
Let's hear it. Brace yourselves, folks. The juniper tree from the Grimm brothers.
The mother took the little boy and chopped him up. She put the pieces into a pot and cooked them into a stew. Little Marlena, the sister, stood by the fire and wept so hard that the stew didn't need any salt at all because of her tears. When the father came home, he sat down at the table and said, "Where's my son?" The mother brought in a huge dish of stew, and little Marlena was weeping so hard that she couldn't stop. "Where's my son?" the father asked again. "Oh," said the mother, "he went off to the country to visit his mother's great uncle. He's planning to stay there for a while." "What's he going to do there? He didn't even say goodbye to me." "Well, he really wanted to go, and he asked if he could stay for 6 weeks. They'll take good care of him." "Oh, that makes me so sad," said the husband. "It's not right. He should have said goodbye." Then he began eating and said, "Little Marlena, why are you crying? Your brother will be back soon." And he said, "Oh, dear wife, this stew tastes so good. Give me some more." The more the father ate, the more he wanted. "Give me some more," he said. "No one else can have any of it." somehow I feel as if it's all for me.
Now, Maria Tatar reading there from the Grimm Brothers, The Juniper Tree. Oh, my goodness. All right. When they annotated, did they make note of just how grim and ghoulish this is?
It didn't bother them. What they were interested in was this was one of the stories written in a dialect, and they also connected it to myths. That is the myth of Atreus.
Mm-hmm. Make the connection for us.
Atreus feeds theist. Oh, let's not go into that.
But they're saying it went all the way back to Greek mythology.
Yeah.
That it seeped into Germany and into the folktales there.
Well, you have remember Ceres, Demeter, mm-hmm. who rescues her daughter, and what is the daughter doing? She's picking flowers in a meadow when she's spirited away by Hades.
The great and beautiful bull who takes her off.
Yeah,
and we're in the realm of myth right away.
And you could say Beauty and the Beast could go back to tales about Zeus and Europa and...
the Grimm Brothers. Plumbing deep here. Let me go. Christina in Melrose, Massachusetts. Christina, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Good. I'm glad you brought up the juniper tree, Maria. We actually had the author Adam Gidwitz here last week. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. But he told that story to about 200 third through sixth graders at our local library, held them completely spellbound for 20 minutes.
Complete with the yum yum, eat my son stuff, that's delicious stew?
Oh, they thought that was great.
Oh, gosh,
the parents clearly were not as thrilled with the story.
Yeah.
The kids loved it. One point I wanted to bring up is that I think one reason the fairy tales are so appealing to children, especially to boys, is because public education is often a girls' world, where you're rewarded for being quiet and, you know, reading what you're told to read and following the rules. A lot of times I think the stories that boys are asked to read are things that they don't engage with as easily. They're told to, you know, stop being rowdy, stop pretending they're Legos or weapons. And I think the Grimm fairy tales speak to all children, but especially to boys, who can really sink their teeth into the world of Grimm, the action, the gore. It's safe, but because it's in a story. It's safe because it's in a story.
Christina, thanks for that. Flip it over. Never mind the misogyny. The boys are happy for this sort of wild and rowdy here.
Oh, but you make a great point about the fairy tale being a safe place to encounter danger and perils and all of that. And I think I love that scene of storytelling with the anxious parents, mm-hmm. but kids who are quite comfortable. And I think maybe we should trust children more with the story, with these stories, especially when there are adults there to talk about it. I think you should never just tell the story and then leave the child with the story.
But you have to be Sigmund Freud to interpret these for the kids?
Oh, I think exactly not. Precisely not. That is, I think there's so much more than just the psychosexual reading of the story. There are all these cultural issues, cultural contradictions that come up in these stories. Innocence versus seduction in Little Red Riding Hood. Monstrosity and compassion in Beauty and the Beast. Hunger and surviving by using your wits in Hansel and Gretel.
The Annotated Brothers Grimm Bicentennial Edition is out. Maria Tatar did the translation. Lots of wonderful interpretation. We'll go out with a little Engelbert Humperdinck Hansel and Gretel Overture back in the 1893 opera. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Maria Tatar. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the myth and dark magic of the Grimm Brothers fairy tales.
opera, folk wisdom there, the fantasy they hold. Maria Tatar is with us, chair of the Folklore and Mythology program at Harvard University and editor and translator of the new bicentennial edition of the annotated Brothers Grimm. A little music right there from Terry Gilliam's 2005, The Brothers Grimm. We just never stop having some kind of wild and crazy fun with these stories. Here's Tex Avery's famous 1943 cartoon short, Red Hot Riding Hood, reimagined Red Rider, Little Red Riding Hood as a nightclub performer who gets an enthusiastic reaction from a wolf in the audience.
We now give you our brand new little sweetheart of swing, that little red-headed ball of fire, Red Hot Riding Hood!
Daddy, I want a diamond ring, I want some bracelets and everything. Daddy, you better get the best for me.
It's a kind of Betty Boop meets the Howlin' Wolf there in 1943. And just last year, Once Upon a Time, TV show premiered about a world where fairy tale characters are real, including many from the tales of the Brothers Grimm. Here's a scene. Rumpelstiltskin, played by Robert Carlyle, speaks with Belle of Beauty and the Beast, played by Emily DeRavin.
Why do you spin so much?
Sorry, it's just you've spun straw into more gold than you could ever spend.
I like to watch the wind. Helps me forget.
Forget what?
I guess it worked.
There we are. TV has its way. What's the power in these tales? Maria, such interesting feedback online here. Here's Pamela writes on Facebook that she's read the original fairy tales to her kids. Anyway, a book given to her by her grandmother, comes from the early 1900s. The book is so fragile, she says, but we treasure the non-Disney version of Cinderella. Mm-hmm. Shake and shiver, little tree, throw gold and silver over me, and all that language. Alyssa says, Bruno Bettelheim's The Meaning of Enchantment, loves the book, addressed how these stories help children work through feelings and fears, especially with the help of a cuddling parent. But she says, but I teach high school, and most of my students, Alyssa writes to us, are only now vaguely aware of these stories. What has replaced them in our modern society? What about that, Maria?
Well, for many years, Disney was our portal to these stories. So often, students will come to my courses, and they think that Disney made up Many think that Disney made up these fairy tales. They are around us, though, in ways that I think we just somehow don't take note of. That is, Hollywood sends us messages on almost a daily basis about the importance of these tales.
What do you mean? That they're embedded in
Something like Sex and the City. Mm. It's filled with fairy tale motifs. The obsession with shoes. Carrie rides in a coach in Central Park at one point. Fairy tales are even mentioned from time to time. But so many of our cultural stories allude to these mm-hmm. fairy tales. They're sort of peppered throughout.
But if we don't tell them or read them explicitly as regularly as we once did, do they gradually just fade into the remix, miasma?
Yeah, they have been remixed, and I think it's today that the fairy tales are being taken up in very explicit ways. That is, we get movies that are called Red Riding Hood, or Beastly, which is about Beauty and the Beast, and announces that Snow White and the Huntsman, Hansel and Gretel, the new version, witch hunters. Mm-hmm. They're adolescent
But yet there's a lot
heroes.
Of mixing and mashing you heard in the TV show. I mean, they've got, here's Belle talking with somebody from an entirely different story.
And that's what, again, the Grimm's version is not sacred. There are no mm-hmm. originals to these fairy tales. We need to keep retelling them. And the extraordinary thing is that the versions that you played just a moment ago give us role reversals. Suddenly, Rumpelstiltskin is not so evil. Mm-hmm. He's actually a victim, and he's somebody that we begin to understand and empathize with. Red Hot Riding Hood, she is the predator. The wolf still looks like a wolf in that version. But what do we have today? We have a film like Hard Candy, in which Ellen Page wears a red sweatshirt with a hood, looks quite sweet and innocent, and ends up performing a very scary operation on a man who is a child molester.
Right.
So,
and off we go.
So these stories have not at all disappeared. We often think, you know, we discard them as we get older. But in fact, they circulate in our culture. Sometimes it's just cultural debris all over the place. But today, more than ever, we seem to be taking up the old stories, reversing their terms and mixing them up in extraordinarily imaginative ways.
Circle back to the Brothers Grimm and what they thought their project was here, beyond just collecting these. You said mentioned earlier they were trying to look back to the pagan past. What was their? Did they have a mission? What was it?
The mission can be defined as trying to preserve a cultural heritage. They understood that these stories were beginning to disappear. They were becoming old wives' tales. They were part of a domestic culture. And, you know, this was not yet the period of industrialization, but rural populations were moving into cities. The hearth, which is the place where the stories had been told, was beginning to disappear, the fireside gatherings. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to collect the tales. They wanted to produce a heritage. And then they also had a kind of hidden agenda, not so hidden in later editions. They wanted to produce a manual for manners. That is,
chop your visitor up this way. Put him in the stew.
For children.
Oh, I see.
That is, so suddenly their Little Red Riding Hood is given a whole set of instructions by mother. That is, don't stray from the path and be sure to say good morning to grandmother when you see her. And don't pick flowers.
Or you may be stew meat, or you may be swept away.
And even something like, don't peer into all of the corners. In other words, don't be a curious child. So they put in all of these lessons. In The Frog King, the father says to the girl, when you make a promise, you must keep it. And even if it is a frog, you've got to let him in and let him sleep in your bed. So sometimes these morals
sturdy,
and messages.
Sturdy, cannibalistic values.
there's a huge disconnect and a clash between the behavioral lesson and what's going on in the story. But still, they added those morals and messages.
You reprint the preface to this first 1812 volume and a later volume in this big version from, I don't know if it was Jacob or Wilhelm or both who wrote it, but it's very literate and aware. These were smart guys.
They were. Remember, they were writing the first German dictionary. They were collecting medieval manuscripts. They were editing. They spent most of their lives not out on the road collecting tales, but in their study, where the two of them worked and had a wonderful collection of note cards. They annotated manuscripts, and they were bookish, for sure. Bookish and erudite.
They write in here, these narratives always end by opening the prospect of boundless happiness. Again, this Grimm Brothers writing. Evil is also neither inconsequential nor something close to home, and not something very bad to which one could grow accustomed, but something terrible, black and wholly alien. You cannot even get near. The punishment of evil is equally terrifying. And on they go. I mean, they're really thinking in their way. They're really thinking these through. At the same time, you can't help looking at both what's saved here, a kind of archived of a cultural heritage that may be very valuable, but there's also stuff in here that's so dark. Not everything that we inherit is beautiful.
So dark, but again, you know, I think it's at the end of the preface that they say that these stories strike us like sunshine, no matter where we're standing. So those forces of darkness are conquered. There's this utopian element in the stories. Things will get better. There will be a happily ever after.
Let's go to Albany, New York, and Joan. Hi, Joan. Thanks for calling. You're on with Maria Tatar.
Hi, Tom. It's delightful to talk to you. I always enjoy your discussions.
Thank you.
Years ago, my son gave his younger sister a lovely collection of Grimm's fairy tales. And I was looking through the book to select one of the stories to read to her. And in the table of contents was listed The Jew in the Bush.
Yes.
Which was clearly anti-Semitic. And And I wonder how your guest deals with that portion of the Grimm heritage.
Joan, I'm so glad you raised that, and let us go straight to it. It's right. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of pages of fairy tales here, but yes, page 393 in this great book. Her translation is Brambles, the Jew in the Brambles. Speak to this story.
Yes, and
Maria.
I'm glad you brought that up, because in his new collection, Philip Pullman does not include that story, and in a discussion about the Grimm's fairy tales, he tells us, no, this should not be reprinted. I say
because
just
it's a vessel for anti-Semitism is his...
Because it's virulently anti-Semitic. The Jew is tortured and...
Tell us the story in a nutshell, and then we can judge for ourselves about his restraint and your inclusion. But what's in a nutshell?
It's basically the story of an apprentice who manages to outwit a Jew and then tortures him by playing his violin.
The poor Jew is in the brambles. He's playing the violin,
brambles,
so he's dancing prickling
death,
deeper and deeper. It's,
and then
it's
is
terrible.
Executed mm-hmm. in the end. So it's a horrifying story. And we should not forget that the Grimms wrote it down, and that story was included not only in the edition of 200 Tales, but also in the special edition of 50 Tales, specifically for children.
Wow.
And it is still in editions today that are designed for German children. So I think we mustn't forget, we should also look at the history of that story, how it migrated into other collections, how it was illustrated by Arthur Rackham.
Is this a version of Brer Rabbit? Or I don't know.
There are versions that you can read, many different versions. Some have a cleric in the role of the Grimm's
Jew. A Christian cleric instead of, yeah.
Okay, so why did the Grimms, who were enlightened, tolerant, democratic, why did they choose this version?
And why did you choose to include it, given all the history since then,
because,
the Holocaust, everything else?
Because why would we erase it? We need to know what they recorded, what was being read. Erasing it, I think, suggests, you know, that we just want to pretend that it didn't happen. It did. The story is there, and there are many who have objected to including. I included in a section of Tales for Adults, mm-hmm. and this is really it's annotated, mm-hmm. it's illustrated.
You have plenty to say about it. It's not just thrown out there
yeah.
naked.
So again, I would say the story was in the collection, and we need to be aware of it.
Eyes wide open here. Yeah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Ruth in North Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Ruth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi,
hi
Maria. It's so good to hear both of you talking about my favorite subject, stories. I'm a storyteller. I've been doing stories since the mid-80s in both England and in America now where I live. And I just want to tell you, storytelling and story collecting is alive and well. I collected stories from Scottish travelers. That's the term that's used for what used to be gypsies or tinkers, which is not used anymore. And all of these areas of these archetypal stories with these kind of overcoming evil or not
mm-hmm.
Are available in stories. And I tell them to everyone from the very youngest children with their parents right through to seniors.
So, Ruth, let me ask you, it sounds like you yeah. tell quite a wide array of yeah. stories. How do the Grimm Brothers stories strike your contemporary audiences? I'm sure you're very finely attuned to how they respond.
All right. So here's the thing. I have to say with apology that, Professor Maria has said, the stories that Grimm collected were actually in other parts of Europe, I would think, because the Scottish travelers that I collected from, who are now deceased, would have been in their 80s now. And so I have told stories, for instance, Jack and Death. There are a lot of Jack tales. And I've told them to as young as 6 years old, and the children seem to get it. I just want to say they just seem to understand, as other speakers have said or callers have said, they're not as afraid as the parents. They seem to understand that it is safe in a story to be scared, to have incredibly frightening things happen, but to come out okay. And that's how I perceive their response to the stories. As far as Grimm is concerned, those were the stories I read by the hour, being one girl in a family of brothers. So I was by myself reading stories, Perrault fairy tales, Grimm fairy tales, yeah. Hans Christian Andersen. So I was very young, and I frightened myself to death, but I still felt safe.
And look, it made a storyteller out of you. Ruth, I'm so glad for your call. Hey, Maria, we've only got a minute here. How do you think these things roll forward? I mean, here you've planted the flag again with a bicentennial edition. In another century, will we still be talking about these tales? Do they eventually just become embedded in other stories and other collections? Where does it go?
I think the Grimms were pioneers in that they put the stories between the covers of a book, just as Charles Perrault did in France and others did in the same century, but later. So we need to be aware of all of these different traditions, and it is not just Grimm, as your previous caller said. There's so many extraordinary cultures and traditions that we can look to, and the stories will, on their own, stay alive. They will continue to circulate. They are what makes us human. They make the human world, and they do make us human. They keep us talking about issues that are vital to our well-being and to our survival.
Maria Tatar, editor and translator of the new bicentennial edition of the Annotated Brothers Grimm. It's a beautiful book. Thank you so much for being with us today, Maria. Listeners, thanks for joining us. A dream is a wish your heart makes. Yeah, Disney. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Love